Welcome to Rewatching Oscar, the movie podcast that focuses on the Academy Awards, and more specifically, the Best Picture winner of each and every year the Oscars have taken place. I will analyze the winner in depth, and then give you my decision on whether the film actually deserved the big prize, or another gem from that year should have been awarded that gold statuette. My name is Jack Ferdman, and I am your host on this journey of rewatching each and every Academy Award winner. Hello again, everyone. This is awesome. We're back once again for another episode of Rewatching Oscar. My name is Jack Ferdman. As always, I'm your host. Like, where am I going to go? You think I'd leave all of you, you know, hanging out there and not share, you know, my bi-weekly take on the Best Picture winner from the past? Come on. Well, first of all, you know I love doing this. And secondly, hearing all of your responses and support, well, it just makes me so happy to hear that there are tons of you passionate cinephiles like myself who want more than just, you know, that simple review. Like, you know, this movie was good or this movie was terrible. We need fans that go more in depth than that. I mean, surface reviews are everywhere. Critics do it all the time as well. Even when talking amongst our friends and families, we just kind of just do a basic review. It's great to know that we're mostly smarter than that and more educated than that. Now, we as movie lovers need to not only fulfill our passions for this art form, but we need to express it with others. We belong to many Facebook groups and clubs, we read books and articles on film, and we listen to podcasts like this one that talk in depth about topics on cinema. And of course, the topic on cinema here is Rewatching Oscar, which is rewatching an old Best Picture winner and analyzing in depth and to see which film was the best from that year. So, you know what? Let's just get into this week's movie. Well, the year that the Wheel of Oscar landed on the last episode of Rewatching Oscar was 2005. And the film that won the Academy Award for Best Picture that year was Crash. Yes, Crash. Crash won the Oscar. People were stunned. Now, this was not the movie anyone really expected to take home the big prize that night. So what happened? How did this movie beat out all the other contenders? Well, it's a question that people even today are still asking themselves. Well, I'll get to that later in this episode, I promise you. Well, let's talk about this film. Crash is a crime drama directed and written by Paul Haggis that was actually released on September 10th, 2004 at the Toronto International Film Festival, but was eligible for the 2005 Academy Awards as rules state that a film to be eligible for the Oscars has to play for 1 week, minimum of 1 week, in the Los Angeles area in that calendar year. Now, it was released in the U.S. on May 6th, 2005. That's why it's a 2005 film. The film has a mega cast and includes, you know, great actors like Don Cheadle and Sandra Bullock and Matt Dillon, Brendan Fraser, Terrence Howard, Thandi Newton, Michael Pena, Ryan Felipe, Jennifer Esposito, Keith David, Tony Danza, Ludacris, Loretta Devine, and honestly, so many more. It's a huge cast. Okay, so let's get to it. Here's the trailer.
It's the sense of touch. Any real city, you walk, you know? You brush past people, people bump into you. In L.A., nobody touches you. We're always behind this metal and glass.
How far can bullets go?
Thinking about that bullet that came through your window?
Sure. You alright?
I am angry all the time, and I don't know why.
Put your hands on top of your head, man.
Well, you just do what he said.
Now, do you have any guns or knives or anything I might get stuck with?
Your brother's file. Kid's going away for life for stealing a car.
All I need to do to make this experience to frame a potentially innocent man.
Did you find your brother?
Who? Oh.
Tell him to go home.
Why do you keep
said about a certain distance, huh? What, he starts to feel something in panic?
What I need is a husband who will not just stand there.
What did you want me to do? Get us both shot?
Take it!
I just had a gun pointed in my face. And it was my fault because I knew it was going to happen.
Heads in plain sight, step out of the vehicle.
Oh! Honey, stay inside.
Man, don't walk up on me.
I know this man. Get back.
You think you know who you are? You have no idea.
You had a conversation with God, huh? What did God say?
I'm trying to help you.
I didn't ask for your help, did I?
Okay, Daddy. I'll protect you.
It's the sense of touch. I think we miss that touch so much that we crash into each other just so we can feel something.
Something else, honey?
People, man. People.
Okay. Wow, it was interesting listening to that trailer. I just noticed, thought of it for the first time. I was wondering where that music came from in the beginning of the trailer when Don Cheadle's talking. It kind of reminds me of Platoon. If you listen to it, it's almost exactly the same song. I don't know if it is, but it sure sounds like it. Anyway, this is Crash. African-American detective Graham Waters, played by Don Cheadle, and his Hispanic partner, Rhea, played by Jennifer Esposito, are involved in a minor collision with a car being driven by Kim Lee, who's an Asian American woman, played by Alexis Ree. A subsequent exchange of racially charged insults occurs. Waters later arrives at a crime scene where the body of a dead kid has been discovered. Two black men, Anthony and Peter, played by Ludacris and Lorenz Tate, carjack district attorney Rick Cabot, played by Brendan Fraser, and his wife Jean, played by Sandra Bullock. As the men drive away, they see Waters and Rhea investigating the death of a black man killed by Detective Conklin, a white police officer. Conklin claims he fired in self-defense, but Waters and Rhea discover that the man he shot was a fellow officer. At home, Cabot rails that the carjacking incident could cost him re-election because no matter whom he sides with, he will lose either the black vote or the law and order vote. Hispanic locksmith Daniel Ruiz, played by Michael Pena, overhears Jean demanding that the locks be changed again as she suspects that Daniel is a gangster because of his race. Sergeant Ryan, played by Matt Dillon, and his partner Officer Tom Hansen, played by Ryan Felipe, pull over an SUV being driven by African-American director Cameron Thayer, played by Terrence Howard, and his wife Christine, played by Thandi Newton, whom Ryan molests during the stop. Hansen goes to his superior, who is black, played by Keith David, to report Ryan's conduct and requests a transfer. His superior berates Hansen as it will tarnish his career, a black man who made it to the high ranks of the LAPD. In the carjacked SUV, Anthony and Peter hit a Korean man while passing a parked van. They dump him in front of a hospital and drive away. Waters, while having sex with Rhea, gets a phone call from his mother, which leads to an argument about Rhea's ethnicity. Waters later visits his mother, who asks him to find his missing younger brother. Ryan comes across a car accident and finds Christine trapped in an overturned vehicle. Recognizing Ryan, she resists frenetically, but he pulls her out just before the car explodes. Waters is summoned to a meeting with Detective Flanagan, who tells Waters that Internal Affairs has discovered that Conklin has two prior suspicious shootings of black men. Waters informs Flanagan that he and Rhea have discovered that the black officer was driving someone else's car with $300,000 in it, possibly from a drug deal. Flanagan insinuates that if Waters cooperates in helping to burn Detective Conklin, the DA will appoint Waters as chief investigator and clear Waters' brother's criminal record. At the ensuing press conference, Waters reluctantly agrees that, given the evidence, Conklin was likely a racist cop. Anthony and Peter carjack another navigator, which happens to be Cameron's, and a police chase ensues. Hansen, one of the pursuing officers, vouches for Cameron to be let off with a warning. Hansen picks up a hitchhiking Peter, who offends Hansen and suddenly laughing, and when Peter reaches in his pocket, Hansen shoots. P- Peter collapses dead, revealing a statuette of St. Christopher, similar to the one on Hansen's dash. Hansen hides the body in some bushes and burns his car. Waters and Rhea later arrive at the scene, revealed as at the beginning of the film. Waters realizes that Peter is both his missing brother and the dead kid. Waters' mother disowns him over Peter's death. Anthony decides to sell the van to the Korean man he hit earlier, but when he drops it off at a chop shop, he discovers Cambodian immigrants chained in the back. The Korean man was a human trafficker. The chop shop owner offers Anthony $500 per immigrant, but Anthony refuses. He drives the Cambodians to Chinatown and frees them. Anthony passes by a fender bender. One driver turns out to be the insurance adjuster Sergeant Ryan had previously argued with, and the other, an Asian man. An exchange of racially charged insults occurs. Wow. Now, you heard me giggling a couple times throughout it, and that's not because of what the story is about, but how all over the place it is. Anyway, reading this and knowing the movie really well puts the film into certain perspective. I don't even know how to describe it. I guess I'll have to share that right after I give you some more details, like I always do on every podcast, on how well it did at the Oscars and at the box office. Well, Crash had a budget of $6.5 million US in 2005, and which means in 2022, currently, that means it's $9.36 million, and it had a domestic box office gross of $54.6 million US in 2005, which today would be $78.6 million. It's a very profitable film, but not a huge juggernaut when it came to raking in money. But it did make money, of course. It went on to be nominated for 6 Academy Awards, including Best Original Song in The Deep, Best Supporting Actor for Matt Dillon, Best Director for Paul Haggis, and it went on to win 3 Oscars of the 6 nominations for Best Film Editing, Best Original Screenplay for Paul Haggis, and of course, Best Picture. Here's a little trivia about Crash. Usually films that win the Best Picture Oscar are also nominated for the Golden Globes, or many Golden Globe Awards. However, Crash was only nominated for 2 Golden Globes, Best Screenplay and Best Performance by an Actor in a Supporting Role, which was Matt Dillon, which means it's the only film to win the Oscar for Best Picture and not even be nominated for Best Picture at the Golden Globes. That's really, really rare. I mean, it never happened before. It's the only one. Maybe this was one of the years that the Golden Globes got it right and the Oscars didn't, but we'll talk about that too. So now, it's time to avoid any injury, which might be tough to do here, and analyze Crash. Okay, now, where do I begin? How about we talk about this? What this film is really about? Well, we do know the storyline. I just read it to you. However, it does feel like it's all over the place. Maybe Paul Haggis wanted it to be put together so haphazardly. You know, possibly. Probably unlikely. Crash is all about racism. That much is blatantly obvious. And more specifically, it's about a group of LA residents who are linked in some form or another through events occurring throughout the film in a span of just a couple days. Now, there's tons of storylines and characters. You know, there's the police officer that's racist as they come, who has to deal with his father who has a prostate problem, and then he goes and gropes a wife of a television director after pulling them over, and then later on saves her from a fiery automobile accident. That same television director has to deal with the racist producer of the show and decides to cave to every white request it gives him. There's 2 young black men who complain that they've been stereotyped by society as being violent black criminals, and then turn around and carjack a white couple's vehicle. Speaking of the white couple, that's the district attorney of LA and his wife, and they have to deal with the taking of their car. They change their locks, but the wife is unhappy because the locksmith, who is, I think, Puerto Rican, thus must be a gang member. Now, speaking of that DA, he needs to figure out how to avoid the fallout of black guys robbing him. Oh, and then there's another robbery that has to be dealt with. This time, it's an Iranian-owned convenience store, where the owner wants to buy a gun to protect himself. And the locksmith, that same locksmith as previously, tells him he needs a new door and it's never fixed. So then things happen after that. I mean, there's racism in the garage. There's racism on the streets. There's racism at the police department. There's racism even at the detective's home. Every single person we encounter is racist on one level or another. Well, actually, maybe Daniel isn't the locksmith that's played by Michael Pena. He's pretty much of an angel. He does get short with the Persian owner at one point, but only because the Persian owner verbally abuses him. So he seems to be the only one that's not overtly racist. So the question here is, and it's obvious, is why? Why is almost everyone in Crash racist? Why does director and screenwriter Paul Haggis do this? What's his point? Now, the film does present racism as being bad. I mean, thank goodness for that. That's obvious. He actually does something different in this movie than other films don't. He takes stereotypes of many of the characters and turns them on their head. He gives it a 180. And the best example is the two young black men who are represented as victims of society. Now, we may not understand them. I mean, I don't. I mean, I understand their pain, but I'm not a victim of racism. I'm white. I'm a white man. However, we do get the frustration and the pain they have in their dilemma as being the only two black men surrounded by wealthy white people in LA. But then, Haggis all of a sudden turns it around and confirms those stereotypes by having them rob a wealthy young couple. Well, not young, white couple. Now, I have no problem with Haggis trying to do this. After all, it's the aftermath of 9/11. That's when the film takes place. And people are on edge. Everyone wants to blame others. The world is totally upside down, and racism as a whole is definitely a big part of our world. It really never leaves us. In a lot of ways, actually, it's gotten worse. People seem to be on edge, whether it's politics, the economy, and then people are always hiding behind their keyboard in their mom's basement and going on social media to share their brilliant take on race, about cultures that they actually know nothing about, and they're not afraid of any retribution because they're just sitting behind a keyboard and, you know, in the basement. It's totally an insane world we live in right now, and I don't see it getting any better, and it's very sad. But that's kind of what we live in, so I get what Haggis is doing. Haggis and Crash flip things around and around and around. He attempts to show that despite all the hate spewed by each and every character, they're also, you know, still human beings. I mean, the racist cop still cares for his ailing father and then later saves a woman from a burning car. The detective still helps his mom by filling her fridge with groceries, even though he's racist. The ultra-racist wife of the DA, the character played by Sandra Bullock, hugs her Latino cleaning woman because she, at the end, is the only one that helps her in need. The black criminal who carjacks a vehicle later decides not to sell the van because he thinks it's right to set the Cambodian immigrants who are found in the back. And it goes on and on and on. And it actually even happens in reverse. When the policeman's partner, who seems to be against the racist elements of his part of the detective, of the Matt Dillon character, this is the Ryan Felipe character, and you think he's sweet and he's clean cut and everything, he's trying to help out, but then he... there's the kid that the black kid who is hitchhiking, and he picks him up and he thinks something's wrong or whatever, and he shoots him because he thinks he has a gun. So things do happen in reverse. Haggis is trying to show us that each and every one of us has elements of racism, or at the very least a lack of understanding or empathy to other cultures because of ignorance and societal influences. Now, his point is, nothing is really as it seems. And that's fine. I get that. There's nothing wrong with that. However, and this is the big however, he is way too much in our face with it. It's not subtle. And actually, as a film fan, I kind of feel insulted that he's actually insulting the intelligence of the viewer. Right from the beginning, he tells us what the theme of the film is. When Detective Waters, played by Don Cheadle, tells us what we need to watch in the film and how to do it in a specific way. Take a listen.
It's the sense of touch.
What?
Any real city, you walk, you know, you brush past people, people bump into you. In L.A., nobody touches you. We're always behind this metal and glass.
think we miss that touch so much that we crash into each other just so we can feel something.
Come on. That's just hitting us over the head with it. And that's just the first lines spoken in the film. And then his partner Rhea, Jennifer Esposito, gets out of the car at that moment and goes on a racist tirade against the Asian woman who they got into an accident with. This actually film never lets up, and Haggis is relentless. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with making a point and sharing your views on a topic. Directors do that all the time. Screenwriters do it all the time. Especially one as powerful as the topic of race and hate in society. And like I said in the outset, the scenes are done so haphazardly. Haggis tries to link each scene and each character in the way, I don't know, a film like Magnolia did in 1999, 6 years earlier. Now, Magnolia did it very artistically. And the explanation in the beginning of Magnolia is one that talks about coincidences. Or are they coincidences? So it lays out the groundwork. But it still makes you think, you're in Crash? No. It just bangs us over the head and tells us what we should think. We should hate all these characters, but understand that there is more to their lives than just that. Thanks for dumbing it down for us, Mr. Haggis. I was pretty disappointed. Now, there are even scenes that are so ridiculous, like the one where the black man, played by Ludacris, perfect name for the scene, Ludacris, because that's what it is, when he carjacks Terrence Howard's SUV and he fights back and jumps in and drives off with them, and then Terrence Howard takes his gun, and then the police confront Howard as Howard's like breaking down emotionally, and the cop by Ryan Felipe lets him off. Really? That would never, ever happen. And that happens a lot in this movie. Scenes just don't happen in real life, what happened in this film. And what about the scene where the Iranian shop owner, who's upset at the locksmith, goes to his home and the Michael Pena character, I think Daniel, his child, his little girl, runs into the street and jumps on him and he shoots the kid in the back. Well, apparently. And then we realize she's okay. They go inside and leave the shop owner outside. And I mean, come on. If anyone shot or even attempted to shoot my kid, I would either attack him or at the very least call the cops. People don't act this way. It became ridiculous. And I know what he's trying to do. He's doing all these scenes to make it more moving and more emotional and deeper than it really is. And then you have the annoying score in the background, you know, telling us how to feel something. This scene just doesn't work. It's supposed to work. It is an emotional scene, but it doesn't work. And there are lots of coincidences in this movie as well. And that's fine too. But it truly isn't put together well. It's like something I'd submit in my film course in university. And what about the big scene with Matt Dillon's character, who happens to be the person that's there to save Thandi Newton from the burning car after he was the one who sexually assaulted her earlier in the film? I mean, it's pretty amazing that there's only a few people in all of L.A. The scene is shot really well, by the way. It's constructed well. It's edited and lit really beautifully. But honestly, it just feels like the rest of the film. It's just off. I don't understand why he puts things all over the place and literally shoves it down our throat. It just doesn't seem realistic. Now, like I said, as the way the film is made, the technical aspects of it, I actually really like many elements of it. The editing is done really, really well, and I'm glad it actually won the Oscar for that. Or it ended up winning the Oscar. I'm happy it won. The choices of long shots and close-ups by Haggis were really effective. The lighting is clean, and his use of lighting in night scenes is really effective as well. And as for the acting, I honestly can't blame the actors for anything. Overall, with a few performances, but overall, it was really well performed. The actors really stand out in Crash. The ones that really do are people like Michael Pena, the locksmith, really, really good in it. Matt Dillon probably has his best performances of his career. I don't know if I'd give him the Oscar nomination for his role, but he did a great job. Terrence Howard and Thandi Newton were great in it. And others were fine, too. And it worked out well. I mean, Sandra Bullock's character, Sandra Bullock was cast in something she usually doesn't perform in. She's usually not this type of a bitch. But You can see she's very capable of doing so. So the acting was good in it. I actually didn't mind the acting. It's the script and the execution of it. That's the core of any movie. And it really doesn't work here. Haggis tries to be artsy and powerful and bring debate to this important topic of race. And in my mind, he fails. It's an entertaining film. It's not boring whatsoever. I mean, there are many Oscar-winning films that are better than Crash, but less entertaining. But the quality of the story of any film is essential. It's what I learned when I studied film theory and film techniques in university. Focus on the story. Have a meaning for each character. What is their objective? Do they evolve in any way? Is the theme or themes understandable and work hand in hand with the screenplay? Is the film cohesive? Everything else is going to follow if those questions are answered properly. I don't know, this felt like a vehicle for Paul Haggis attempting to share his views on racism. That's all it is. And good on him. That's great. We all need that. But I would have listened to him in a lecture instead of watching 112 minutes of a movie in scenes put together with scotch tape. Oh, and what about the ending? Can they copy Magnolia anymore? Of course. The music at the end is beautiful. It's an amazing song. I actually love it. I'm glad it was nominated for Best Song. But they try to link the scenes and people together through the music. And it would be really effective if the rest of the film wasn't a mess. Like I said, it's a great song. It's beautifully shot. But it just becomes silly when it isn't set up properly. Oh, and of course, it begins to snow in LA. Just like the falling frogs in Magnolia being symbolic. And in this case, what does the snow represent? Is it raining, you know, purifying them that they've, you know, overcome all their racism and realizing that that racism is bad? Is it because it's white and it doesn't feel like it's going away and the battle will continue, so it's actually white snow? I don't know. The cycle continues. And it shows that right at the end of the film, after the snow scene, where there's an accident and two people continue to hurl racist insults at each other. Honestly, there's no subtlety when it comes to Crash. So let me be clear. I don't hate Crash. I really don't. It has elements of it that I did enjoy. It's interesting. It's fairly well acted. And it does bring up issues of race in our society. And that's always a good thing. But I guess I'm just really disappointed. Haggis, the year before, wrote Million Dollar Baby. And he won the best screenplay for that. So he won back-to-back screenplays, actually, because he won for Crash, surprisingly. And although the film also has a controversial subject, like it did in Million Dollar Baby, they talked about euthanasia, and here it's about racism. In Million Dollar Baby, it actually allows the audience to absorb what it sees and make our own evaluation on the topic. Haggis with Crash doesn't do that at all. He force feeds the theme of race and tells us how we should deal with it. I was more shocked that it won for best screenplay, actually, than I was for best picture. But it did win for both, along with best editing. So the question is, how did it happen? How did Crash end up winning best picture? Like I asked in the beginning of this podcast, well, there are a lot of other contenders that were easily better. Well, there are many reasons why it won. First of all, the film is comprised of many mainstream actors, and the Academy loves that, and their voters are comprised of mostly actors, and that gives it a huge advantage over other films. Second reason would be Brokeback Mountain was the heavy favorite amongst critics to win, but they didn't take into consideration that it was maybe not something the Academy voters were ready for. A film about two cowboys who fall in love. They did honor Ang Lee for Best Director, and maybe that was a token to show that they're starting to bend ever so slightly in that direction. I mean, later on, in years later, like Moonlight came through and 12 Years a Slave, where they talk about racism, those won. But they weren't ready for it, I guess, at that time. That's pretty shocking for 2005. It's not that long ago. Also, as I said before, this was not long after 9/11. People were still tense. Race relations in America and around the world were, you know, very divided. The film seemed to address the issue in an entertaining way. It made us look in the mirror and talk about our personal feelings and other cultures. Another reason is Paul Haggis at that time was loved by the Academy. Like I said, he won the screenplay the year before, and he was the hot commodity in writing. So that was another reason. And finally, of course, the marketing of the film was off the charts. They promoted it very well. And remember, it was out there for a long time, so people absorbed it. And And remember, it was released in September of 2004, which means they had well over a year to ponder and absorb this film, unlike Brokeback Mountain, which was released late in 2005. So I guess for all those reasons, the chips fell perfectly for Crash, and it took home the big prize. Well, I need to give this film a rewatch Oscar score. Now, I actually didn't hate the film when I first saw it. I actually liked it. I was entertained, and I just, I guess, let it wash over me way back then. But with this viewing and analyzing in this podcast, I took the time to analyze what this film was about and focused on things like the screenplay and the editing and the acting and the thematics of it all and how it was put together technically. So with all that in mind, I'm going to give it a low-ish score. I'm going to give it a 5.9 out of 10. I didn't hate it, but it definitely is not what I expected on a rewatch. I thought I would enjoy it a bit more than I did, and I didn't. It might be the last time I ever see this film. I don't really need to see it. I've analyzed it enough. Well, so obviously, I'm not going to award Crash the Rewatch Oscar of 2005. So which film will take home my coveted prize? Now, let's go over a bunch. This is what I do every episode. So let me go over a bunch. First one is Hustle and Flow. That's another Terrence Howard film, but it's a really good film. It's about a pimp in Memphis, Tennessee. It's really well done. It's all about his acting, and that's really worth your while. Walk the Line's really good acting by Joaquin Phoenix, and the Oscar-winning performance by Reese Witherspoon. But the film, in my mind, is still overrated. It's a little slow, but the acting is really, really good. How about Syriana. Now, I thought this film hit all the right chords. It's about a Middle Eastern oil industry. Mixes lots of storylines, and this is the way to do it. You have tons of storylines, but it blends very well. I liked it a lot. The acting is great, especially George Clooney, who won Best Supporting Actor for his role. Also has Matt Damon and Jeffrey Wright, Amanda Peet, Chris Cooper, Tim Blake Nelson. Great, great cast. It's really well written by its screenwriter, Stephen Gagan, who also wrote Traffic. And lots of other crime stuff on TV, so he really knew what he was doing. It's a great movie. I love Syriana. There was Cinderella Man, really, really well done boxing film with Russell Crowe as James J. Braddock and Paul Giamatti as his manager. I think his name was Joe Gould. Really well done. It's not a perfect film, but really, really entertaining. An average film called Mrs. Henderson Presents, but Judi Dench and Bob Hoskins are both amazing in it, and it kind of brings back the early 1940s theater feel. If you like that kind of stuff, you'll love it. If you don't, it's a waste of your time. It'll be a waste of your time. There is Felicity Huffman in Transamerica. She does a great job. It's a good film. It's a film that feels it wants to be more meaningful than it really is. It's good. It's just not great. One of the better adaptations of Jane Austen classic novel, Pride and Prejudice, came out that year in 2005. Keira Knightley is amazing as Elizabeth Bennet, but others are great as well. Rosamund Pike is in it. Carey Mulligan, Donald Sutherland, Brenda Blethyn. Honestly, it feels fresh. This feels really fresh, even though it's retelling the same story of, like I said, the Jane Austen classic. It's a good movie. North Country. This is an okay film. Again, it's one of those okay films that a great performance will get you through the imperfections of it. And Charlize Theron, honestly, is one of the great actresses of our time. And honestly, her role in this one is one that people don't talk enough about. She's great in this movie. There's The Constant Gardener, Rachel Weisz's Best Supporting Actress win in a role, but the movie is boring. Oh my God, it was slow. I did not enjoy it. It's not a horrible film, but just very boring. One that's not boring is June Bug, which launched the career of Amy Adams. She's amazing in this, as she is in everything. I honestly can watch this movie many times just because of her. There's the dark animated fantasy film, Tim Burton's Corpse Bride. It's okay. It's not bad. There's Memoirs of a Geisha. I couldn't get into it. People loved it. I didn't. There's the fourth of the Harry Potter franchise, Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. Probably the best of the franchise. I really liked it. But you have to see all of them. So you have to devote yourself to seeing all the Harry Potter films. But the fourth one, think of that. Probably the best one. Goblet of Fire. There was King Kong, which is the third time they brought Kong to the screen. It's definitely not as good as the 1933 version with Fay Wray, but way better than 1976 one with Jessica Lange. This time it's Naomi Watts as the hairy guy's love interest. It's pretty good. It's not great, but it's good. There's Batman Begins. Now, I know a lot of people talk about The Dark Knight as being the best Batman film ever. I actually think The Dark Knight is the best superhero film of all time. But honestly, it shouldn't take away from the one film that gave new life to the Caped Crusader. Batman Begins is so good. Christian Bale is amazing, and it brings a dark brooding tale or dark brooding take with Batman. Oh my God, it's really, really good. Great cast, awesome story, makes it a great watch. There's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Oh, I did not like this take on the creepy factory owner by Tim Burton. I mean, Johnny Depp is fine, but he's no Gene Wilder. It's just weird, and I did not enjoy it. There's a couple good documentaries. March of the Penguins, really sweet. It's narrated mostly by Morgan Freeman. It really pulls on everyone's heartstrings. Really well made. I liked it a lot. Then there's Murderball, which I loved. Great doc about the U.S. quad rugby team, a team composed entirely of young paraplegic men. It's really inspiring and really, really entertaining. Take a look at that. Some docs are better than, like, as we know, are better, but people don't watch them enough. I mean, Murderball is a great movie. There's Tsotsi, a South African film about a young group of thugs prowling the streets of Johannesburg. Really, really good movie. Really powerful. An incredible performance by the lead. I don't know how to pronounce his last name. It's Presley Chweneyag, I think, or Chweneyagi. Sorry for that, but he's incredible in it, and it's really well done. There's Star Wars Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith. So, you know, we had the trio of prequels to the Legendary Trilogy. Well, they left the best for last because Episode 3 is by far the best of the three prequels. I mean, seeing Anakin become Darth Vader was amazing, but the film is much more than that. It's great action, really great storyline to link the two trilogies, and great direction. And it reminds us of how great Star Wars is as a whole. There's War of the Worlds. For some reason, I really love War of the Worlds. It's not perfect, but it's very scary and very exciting. Tom Cruise does a great job. And yes, it did make me cry at the end. I don't know why. It just tug at me when he brings back his daughter. I don't know. Anyway, let those emails begin. Tell me how much of a wimp I am. I'm not afraid. I love crying at movies. There's Squid and the Whale. There's a movie you want to really cry at. Not a lot of people talk about this movie. It's really good and emotional. It's about divorce and the effects everyone feels from that. Jeff Daniels is really good in it. A young Jesse Eisenberg who plays his son stands out. He's really amazing in this gem. Not surprised he became a star after this movie. There's Coach Carter, Samuel L. Jackson basketball movie. It's pretty good. Assault on Precinct 13. Why would you ever want to watch a remake when the original is absolutely incredible? Yeah, I guess you have to, but oh, what a waste. This one has Lawrence Fishburne, Ethan Hawke, and John Leguizamo, and Maria Bello. All great actors. But the screenplay is horrible the way they wrote it up, and the actors don't do the film's essence of the film justice. The original is so much better. One of the best films of the 70s. Ignore this remake. There's a special movie for me. A movie called Pooh's Heffalump Movie. Yes. Pooh's Heffalump Movie. It's not that good. Now, why is it special and important to me? Because it's the first movie I ever took my daughter to. She was 4. We were in Florida. I took her to see this movie, and honestly, I was melting. She was crying in it. She was scared at times, loved it. Yeah, special movie for me and my daughter. There's Constantine, which actually I liked with Keanu Reeves and Rachel Weisz. Looks kind of silly on paper, and critics didn't really go to it, but I liked it a lot. It's really cool looking. It's a fun ride. Great scenes. Never saw the comic book, but series Constantine. But I liked it. And you can follow me. Listen to me. Go watch this movie. It's pretty good. I'll never guide you the wrong way. Well, I won't try to anyway. Then there's Son of the Mask. I mean, why are you doing that? This movie, Be Cool. Why would you do the sequel to Get Shorty? Get Shorty's so good. Robots isn't that great. Miss Congeniality 2 isn't good. The Amityville Horror remake, Why are they doing these remakes? I don't understand. Sin City, it's okay. It's cool looking. It's dated, but it's cool looking with a black and white style with the dashes of bloody red color in it. I like that, but it's okay. Fever Pitch is a cute movie. I'd never like Jimmy Fallon, but he's okay in this film. And Drew Barrymore is always cute in every movie. And the ending of the film is the best part. I guess the geeks should unite while they're watching The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. This movie, if you're a geek, is for you, but it's not for me. XXX State of the Union is a terrible action film. The Sandlot 2 is terrible. Bewitched is horrific. Fantastic Four is not even that good. It was the first of all those Marvel films, and they did get better and better, but Fantastic Four was not good. Bad News Bears remake, this time with Billy Bob Thornton, is not good. Why would you do it when you had Walter Matthau in the original? I don't know. The Dukes of Hazzard is bad. Deuce Bigelow, American Gigolo, a lot of bad movies. Lilo and Stitch Part 2, Transporter Part 2. Wow. I don't know why they have so many bad films coming out at once. There was a silly doc called The Aristocrats. It's a doc about a joke. If you haven't heard about this one, it's really weird, but a joke that's told in a million different ways by the greats of stand-up comedy. The joke itself isn't funny, but the vile manner in which it's told is amazing. It's just nice to go behind the scenes and hear these greats of comedy and hear them. It's like their comedic brotherhood. I liked it a lot. I laughed a lot, but it was very cool. Must Love Dogs is cute because of John Cusack and Diane Lane, but the movie itself is not good. The 40-Year-Old Virgin, great film. Loved it. Everything about it. It's just so funny. Steve Carell is amazing. You got Paul Rudd and Seth Rogen and Catherine Keener and Jane Lynch is great and all the rest. The lines are amazing. There's tons of improv in this film, which I love, and they left it in, including that famous chest waxing scene for when Steve Carell gets his chest hairs waxed and all the actors are laughing behind them. That's actually real. They kept that in there. They were laughing in the entire movie. I love that. There's The Exorcism of Emily Rose. Now, it's a film that people compare to The Exorcist, and if they do, they're going to be disappointed. But honestly, nobody should. It stands out on its own, and it's very, very scary. I liked it a lot. It's a story not only about exorcism, but it's about schizophrenia and ultimately the law. But who are we kidding? We watch movies to be scared, and The Exorcism of Emily Rose does succeed in that. There's terrible films like Elizabethtown and the remake of The Fog and Saw 2. Just stick with the originals with those. Jarhead is average, but Jake Gyllenhaal's great. Rent came out that year. I guess if you couldn't see one of my favorite Broadway shows ever, then you probably are okay to settle with this movie. But if you're a Rent head like I am, you're going to be disappointed with the film. There's The Producers, and a really fun musical version of the 68 classic comedy. Now, I have a special place in my heart for this film as well, because in theater, I played Leo Bloom twice on stage, the Matthew Broderick character, Bloom, in some amateur theater productions, and it was just fun to do that. It's such a fun film. The stage version is better, though, but Leo Bloom, that's me. The remake of Fun with Dick and Jane is terrible. Cheaper by the Dozen 2 is bad. And possibly one of the worst movies and cringeworthy movies ever is called The Ringer. Avoid it. Don't even look it up. It's a waste of time. The Ringer, don't care. There's Match Point. A really good Woody Allen film. It's a lot to nitpick about this film, but honestly, it's pretty cool. It's a murder mystery and infidelity. I found it fun. And Scarlett Johansson's really good at it. There's Capote. Didn't really love this film, believe it or not, but the performance by Philip Seymour Hoffman, the late Philip Seymour Hoffman, is amazing. It's fine. I was happy he won, but the film is nothing special. Munich is a really good movie by Steven Spielberg. Surprised it got nominated for Best Picture, but I still liked it a lot. It's about the telling of the story about the hostage taking by the Israeli athletes in the 72 Munich Olympics and the aftermath. Eric Bana and Daniel Craig are great in it. Very good film. So there's lots and lots of films, as you can see, every time. A lot of really bad ones, but many good ones, and many way better than Crash. However, there are five in my mind that stand out. I do this every time, don't I? That stand out as the best films of 2005 for one reason or another. Anyway, these are the five. The first one is, in no particular order, so here we go, A History of Violence. Now, this is a movie that I really don't want to tell you too much about because of the twists and the impact are huge, and they had an impact on me as well. Not only is the storytelling great, but the acting across the board is so top-notch, especially from Viggo Mortensen, who I'm so happy was nominated for Best Actor in this role. The film gets you from the opening scene and doesn't let go. It's so well done. The skill David Cronenberg uses in his direction is off the charts. His pacing is amazing. The editing is perfect. He doesn't rush any shot. It's so good. I can't wait really to watch this again. It's one of my favorite films from this year. And you can't forget about Ed Harris and William Hurt's incredible supporting roles. Honestly, it's incredible. Then you have, of course, Brokeback Mountain. Now, this film, everyone thought was going to win Best Picture. Ang Lee did win Best Director for this movie that everyone calls, like I said before, the gay cowboy film. Now, this movie is much, much more than that. It's so powerful. It's about love and loss. It's about a world of fear, both from the perspective of those who are in love and those who don't understand, and how someone is, and how people are threatened by it. It's a world that unfortunately still exists today. That those heartbreaking performances by both Jake Gyllenhaal and Heath Ledger are outstanding. Now, I talked about pacing by Cronenberg in History of Violence. Ang Lee also shows how important it is to have a story unfold in front of your own eyes and trusting the audience to lose themselves in the love of the two men. It's so beautiful to watch, and the cinematography is perfect. Then there's Good Night and Good Luck. Now, this movie, directed by George Clooney, is amazing. If you love news, specifically American news like I do, then this film will really hit you hard. The story of journalist Edward R. Murrow, played to perfection by David Strathairn, focuses on the senator that hurt America with the McCarthy hearings. That would be, of course, Senator Joseph McCarthy. The true story of the CBS journalist is beautifully filmed in black and white. The lighting, the editing, the screenplay, the acting, including amazing performances, supporting performances by Clooney and Robert Downey Jr. and Jeff Daniels is in it, and Patricia Clarkson and Frank Langella. This film is riveting. I loved it. Then there's Wallace and Gromit in The Curse of the Were-Rabbit. That's something completely different, right? Well, how can you not love this movie? I mean, absolutely love Wallace and Gromit. It is as entertaining a film, whether it's animated or not, that was released in 2005. It is original. The plot is inventive. And the characters are so, so goofy and lovable that you just can't get enough. It's hysterical, yet it's also serious and exciting when it needs to be. And the stop-motion animation is amazing. Same kind of animation that brought films like, you know, that fantastic film Chicken Run to audiences. This film is even better than that. I also love all the references to things of the past, like it honors horror films. It's as close to a perfect animated film as there ever was. And then finally, of the fifth one, of the ones that I said are the top five films of the year, is a film called Du Untertang. In translation, that means downfall. Now, this film was released in Germany and other places in Europe in 2004, but in the UK and the US and in Canada, it was released in 2005. Now, you're probably saying to yourself, huh? What? Never heard of it. Well, you may never have seen the whole film, but I'm sure you've seen a clip from the movie that's used in a meme on YouTube over and over again, especially in the early 2010s. Now, here's the scene that you've seen. Hitler, in his office, is being told by his men, and he's in trouble as the Soviets are getting closer to getting him and ending the Nazi hold on the war. Hitler sends everyone out of the room except for his four top men, and then he loses it on them. But in the YouTube clip that you're seeing, the subtitles at the bottom, they talk about sport things like sports and movies and American politics and even random current events. It's truly hysterical to watch. But that's the meme that you know. The movie itself focuses on the final weeks and days of his terror. It's filmed in a way that creates an air of tension and never lets up. even though we know what's about to happen. We know Hitler's going to be caught. Bruno Ganz's portrayal of Hitler is nothing short of remarkable, and it's absolutely ridiculous that he wasn't nominated for Best Actor. People have said there are moments in this film that sympathize with Hitler, or at least humanize him. That's kind of the point of the movie. We are all humans, some good, some bad, and some purely evil, like Adolf Hitler. So to make Hitler into a character, or a caricature, that's just a maniac, that's just maniacal for no reason, would minimize the power of this film. It would be ridiculous. This movie, Downfall or Der Untertang, is a truly special movie. And even more powerful today, as we're witnessing what's happening now with Russian President Vladimir Putin as he attempts to take over Ukraine. I mean, some movies are just great, but some stand the test of time and are important. This is truly one of them. So, those are the five films. And it's really tough to decide which will get my rewatch Oscar. I mean it. I have to make that decision. I do not let it hang. I always pick the one film. I never have a tie. So, although films like Wallace and Gromit and Der Untertang and Brokeback Mountain are all very, very special films and could easily have been my choices, my choice for best film on other years, no, it comes down to only two for me. And those are Good Night and Good Luck and The History of Violence. Yes, those are my top two. And these two films that are still as good today as they were when they were first released. In both films, I felt I was right there in the movie. I was in very different ways affected by both of them in a very, very powerful manner. But I have to pick one. So, I think I'm going to go with The History of Violence by the narrowest of margins. Now, I probably will change my mind several times in my life. That's what happens. People evolve and they change and they have different feelings or whatever for when they're, you know, in their specific time of life. But for now, The History of Violence is my choice. Now, it was a bit more entertaining than other films, and the twist really hit me hard, and I still appreciate it now with the screenplay, now as I did back then, especially with the reveal, and the acting is amazing. But anyone who picks any other of the four films, I would never argue with you, because all five are amazing, but I still will still hold to my choice and give Rewatch Oscar for 2005 to A History of Violence. Wow, there you have it. Okay, so now it's time to find out what year and film I'll be revisiting on the next episode of Rewatching Oscar. I love this part, you all know that. So let me get that Wheel of Oscar out and turn up the volume so you can hear it and give it a big spin. There we go. Okay. Wow, I'm so excited. I love this part. Oh my God, yes, yes. Okay, I always wanted to wait to see when a couple of years, my favorite years or favorite films from specific years would come up. You know, all the greats that really stand out, the big, big films. And there were a couple, and this is one of them. So the wheel has fallen on 1976. So, the best picture of 76 was Rocky. Yes, Rocky. I'm so psyched. It's one of my favorite films growing up, and I've obviously seen it many, many times, and I'm sure you have as well. Wow. So, analyzing it on this podcast is going to be fun. I can't wait. Rocky, I get to do Rocky. Wow, it's like a little kid in a candy shop. I'm actually pretty giddy right now. I love it. Okay, so let's figure out what else was nominated. There were a lot of some really good films in 76 that were nominated alongside this classic. One was All the President's Men, great film. Bound for Glory, Network is a great film, and Taxi Driver. Wow, it's going to be a tough decision to make. Who's going to take the Rewatch Oscar of 1976? That's unreal. And of course, there are other films as well that were definitely in the running for my Rewatch Oscar, as they are every episode. It's definitely going to be an interesting episode. Yes, I get to do Rocky. I'm so excited. Okay, well, thanks again for downloading and listening to this episode of Rewatching Oscar. It's always so much fun doing this, not just for me, but for not just for myself, but all of you fans out there. It really is a special journey, and I just love it. Again, thanks for all your support and subscribing, you know, and following and being a part of this journey of Best Picture winners here on Rewatching Oscar. Don't forget to tell everyone about it and give us a 5-star rating as it helps this podcast grow. Continue to listen to Rewatching Oscar on any of your favorite podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, Podchaser, Podcast Addict, and many others. Please let me know what you think of the film I talked about today, Crash, or any other film from 2005, or any other year even. I just love hearing from you. You can leave us a message on Facebook Messenger, which most people do, which I love, or you can even email me at jack@rewatchingoscar.com. So, until the next episode, when I'll be revisiting 1976, and more specifically, the Best Picture winner of that year, Rocky. I can't wait, honestly. As I always do, sending big movie hugs to all of you. Right now, the world seems to be a bit upside down right now. It's really difficult for everyone. I'm praying for all those who are suffering around the world, and especially in Ukraine. My heart is there with you. It's really tough. So be good to each other. We all need it, and stay safe. My name is Jack Ferdman, and keep watching those greats. Bye for now. Rewatching Oscar's music is by Turpak. The podcast logo and producer of Rewatching Oscar is Jack Ferdman. You can listen to all episodes of Rewatching Oscar on your favorite podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Podcast Addict, Podchaser, and many others. Please follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Also, check out our website, www.rewatchingoscar.buzzsprout.com, for all episodes.